Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. My name is Svetlana Ganz. I'm a partner at Gibson Dunn and a member of the Federalist Society's Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group. We welcome you all here. Our practice group offers a variety of programs on SEC, FTC, DOJ, antitrust, and related issues, and we hope you will all contact us to get more involved with our committee. Today, I'm honored and pleased to introduce the moderator for this panel focusing on ESG policy, the Honorable Judge Andrew Olam from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Before ascending to the bench, Judge Olam served as general counsel to Texas Governor Greg Abbott, where he advised the governor on a range of issues and managed litigation in which the governor was an interested party. Previously, he served as a deputy solicitor general for the state of Texas, where he represented Texas in federal courts across the country, including twice before the U.S. Supreme Court. Before moving to Texas, Judge Olam was an attorney in private practice and clerked for Justice Alito and Judge David Sentell of the D.C. Circuit. Judge Olam received his bachelor's from the University of Virginia, a master's from Cambridge University, and a law degree from Harvard Law School. Please join me in welcoming the Honorable Judge Olam and the rest of the panel for today.
Thank you, Svetlana, and thank you all for attending this panel on a very important topic. For decades, and when I was a student, an undergraduate in graduate school studying economics and economic issues, it seemed like everyone agreed that perhaps the most bedrock foundational concept in all of microeconomics, at least, was that the purpose of the firm was to maximize profit and to maximize shareholder return. It was a foundational concept and the foundational premise for all manner of things. It was the foundational premise for securities law and securities regulation. It was a foundational concept for securities litigation, for corporate governance and accounting, for antitrust principles, government regulation and deregulation for decades and for generations. But today, there has been a significant push and a significant attempt to change that paradigm and to redefine the purpose of the corporation, and that's the topic that we're here to discuss today. So I'll throw out, as we start and open our panel and our conversation today, two of these paradigm-shifting attempts at redefining the purpose of the corporation. The one, and perhaps the biggest earthquake in this area, was the Business Roundtable's 2019 revision of the quote-unquote the purpose of a corporation. So for those unfamiliar, the Business Roundtable is a group of 181 of the largest CEOs of the largest corporations in America, and they changed their definition of the purpose of a corporation, which had, as I said, had been for generations to maximize shareholder return. In 2019, they changed it to say the following, quote, companies should serve not only their shareholders, but also deliver value to their customers, invest employees, deal fairly with suppliers, and support the communities in which they operate. We foster diversity and inclusion, dignity and respect. We respect the people in our communities and protect the environment by embracing sustainable practices across our businesses. I'll give you another one. This is from Marty Lipton and several of his partners from Wachtell Lipton, which came from a group of the World Economic Forum. I'm sorry, this is a statement that they had developed for the World Economic Forum and then had published in a corporate governance magazine at Harvard. And this is what the partners at Wachtell Lipton say is the simple formulation of the corporate purpose. The purpose of a corporation is to conduct a lawful, ethical, profitable, and sustainable business in order to create value over the long term, which requires consideration of the stakeholders that are critical to its success, shareholders, employees, customers, suppliers, creditors, and communities, as determined by the corporation and the board of directors using its business judgment and with regular engagement with shareholders who are essential partners in supporting the corporation's pursuit of this mission. So we've gone from shareholder return and shareholder value is the only thing that matters to that it is perhaps one, if the least important, of the various considerations in the purpose of a firm. This has created all manner of fallout consequences. We have now entirely new methods of doing things that, when I was studying this topic 20 years ago, just was basic math. So we've gone from sort of the basic principles of normal accounting that operated when I was studying it to entire new methods of accounting, including the so-called triple bottom line, which has been described as social, environmental, and economic, or people, planet, and profit. So now, instead of just doing dollars and cents and measuring shareholder return, now we have to do corporate accounting to incorporate people and planet, and profit comes in, but only at the end. So this has created all manner of consequences for the topic of the panelists that are here to join us today. I would encourage you to look in your programs at their various bios. They're incredibly accomplished and influential. I won't go through them in great detail today. I will just give you their affiliations, and I will give you a brief sort of introduction of them, and then I'll let them speak for themselves. So our first speaker is going to be Ms. Dahlia Blass. She is the head of external affairs for BlackRock and the former director in the Division of Investment Management at the Securities and Exchange Commission. After her, we will hear from Jonathan Berry, who is a partner at Boyden Gray & Associates and a former acting assistant secretary for policy at the Department of Labor. After Mr. Berry, we'll hear from the Honorable Christine Wilson, a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. And then last but certainly not least, we will hear from Mr. Douglas Gayho, Chief Counsel for Antitrust, Commercial and Administrative Law at the U.S. House Committee on the Judiciary. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Ms. Blass.
Thank you, Judge Oldham, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in today's panel discussion. I very much look forward to our dialogue. Before I start, just a quick note that my remarks today, anything I say, they are my own views and do not reflect the views of BlackRock or any of my colleagues at BlackRock. I just left the government, so I'm really used to disclaimers. To help contextualize the work, where I work, I'd like to spend just a minute laying out our firm, the industry, and the overall approach we have to managing our clients' assets. As more and more clients have entrusted us with their assets over the years, our firm has grown. And with that growth comes increased interest in what we do and why. And I welcome this opportunity to share my perspective and answer any questions. Over the course of BlackRock's evolution, we've grown into one of the leading asset management firms across the globe. And we do that by making investing more and more accessible, more affordable, and delivering value to our clients. And value means returns. In the last 20 years alone, we have helped reduce the average expense ratios of U.S. open-end funds and ETFs. I'm sure all of you in the room have holdings in these great vehicles. By over 50%. That's real money in investor pockets. While BlackRock is synonymous today with index investing, our roots are actually as an active bond manager. When BlackRock started, our edge was understanding and managing risk in bond portfolios better than anybody else. And that ethos, understanding and managing risk, that remains the core purpose of our firm. Our business is all about choice. We have the largest platform in the industry that provides clients with choice in how they want to invest their money. We've succeeded by offering clients a very wide range of choice from which they can choose to meet their own investment objectives and their financial needs. The ultimate decision about where their money goes, how they invest, is theirs. Our clients, by the way, range from large institutional investors like public pension plans to individuals contributing into 401k plans or buying our funds for the very first time as they start their investing career. We are capitalists when we really believe in the power of the capital markets. Anything that we have done, from our voting to our views on the transition to a low-carbon economy, we do that as a fiduciary with the goal of driving value returns to our clients. Our only agenda is performance and value for our clients. Investing is one of the few jobs, by the way, where you get a daily scorecard. When the market's closed, how have you performed? Have you underperformed or outperformed your benchmark? Are you delivering value for your clients? If not, by the way, they will find someone else who can do that. With that focus on risk, choice, and a robust capital market, we take an active role in responding to regulatory initiatives that would impact our clients. We pride ourselves on being the voice of the investor. This is why we actively engage with the SEC and the DOL and others on key regulatory initiatives in the ESG space. So let's start with that. Let's start with the SEC. which I have to say has been quite active in the climate space and engaged in a multi-pronged whole agency effort to enhance and mandate climate-related disclosures across market participants under its jurisdiction. I'll touch briefly on three key proposals, but I will note at the start, this is just three of others. There are others out there in the ecosystem, including one that just came out today from the GSA for federal contractors. First, the SEC has proposed extensive disclosure requirements on public companies. The key provisions include, first, disclosure of GHG emissions that covers scope 1 and 2, and if material, or if the company has set targets scope 3, and with third party attestation, that's essentially an auditor doing the attestation for scopes 1 and 2. Second, disclosure of any transition plans, internal carbon pricing, climate-related targets and goals adopted by the company, and progress towards such goals. Third, disclosure of climate-related risks over the short, medium, and long term with their impact on business activities. Fourth, disclosure of corporate governance of climate-related risks and the process for managing these risks. And fifth, disclosure of qualitative and quantitative risks and historical impact in the notes that are audited financial statements presented on a disaggregated basis if the aggregated impact is 1% or more of the total line item. That's a lot. Importantly, by the way, the proposed disclosures would generally be filed, not furnished, liability. What that means essentially translates into strict liability for the issuers. Shortly after this rule was proposed, what was proposed in March, in May, the SEC moved to require disclosure for funds and advisors. For the funds, the SEC proposed a layered disclosure framework based on whether a fund is an ESG integration fund, an ESG-focused fund, or an impact fund, with the level of detail increasing as you go from integration to impact. And the proposed disclosures would include voting and engagement, as well as, in certain cases, also GHG emissions. And for advisors also that consider ESG factors, they also would have mandated disclosures in their in the documents they file with the SEC on an annual basis and in their client correspondence. And that also would include voting. Finally, the SEC proposed amendments to what's called the NAMES rule. It's a rule that's an existing rule. It's been in the books since 2001. To cover strategies, including ESG. The current rule requires that if you have, requires 80% in the portfolio to be invested in assets that track the name. So just by way of example, if you are a fixed income fund, 80% of that portfolio should be in bonds. So touching on where BlackRock is with respect to these SEC proposals, and then I'll cover DOL briefly. Generally, our views are broadly aligned with the SEC's because BlackRock has consistently advocated for providing the markets and investors with high-quality, globally comparable climate-related disclosures. However, we do believe some changes would improve the proposals. For the climate issuer rule, we provided a very extensive comment letter. You can find it on our website. And I'll just briefly touch on three key pieces of it, but it's a pretty long letter. First, we recommended adherence to the very well-established definition of materiality. For example, if you look at the proposed changes to the financial statements, this 1% item I mentioned, 1% threshold is, we do not believe that is financially material. And materiality is pretty key and has driven disclosure in the federal security space since I was a baby attorney, if not before. Second, we recommended alignment with the TCFD framework. And if you're not familiar with that, that's the framework that generally is very widely used. It's a principles-based framework that issuers globally have used, are using now for climate-related disclosures. And parts of that proposal went, really well beyond the TCFD, introducing prescriptive, granular, costly, and in some cases, comparatively harmful information. And third, we urge the Commission to consider the impact on the U.S. capital markets of imposing disclosures solely on U.S. public issuers. We noted that this could encourage the sale of physical assets from public to private. We also noted that it could disincentivize private companies from going public, which would reduce choice in the public markets and impact capital formation. And finally, we also recommended appropriate liability standards to reflect the evolving nature of this disclosure. By way of example, we recommended the Commission consider proposing a new form which would not have the strict liability standard of the 10K, the annual report, which is where they proposed to have the disclosure for certain elements of the proposal, such as the GHG emissions and transition plans. On the funds and advisor rules, we support the Commission's goal of reducing investor confusion and guarding against greenwashing in the markets. But we again suggested certain improvements in order to meet those goals. For example, we recommended the Commission remove the ESG integration fund category because ESG integration is not a fund. It is an investment process, and its portfolio managers have been using that since, you know, a very long time as they look at climate risks and other ESG risks. We also recommended removing the added layer of stewardship disclosures, because stewardship is not a definitive characteristic of ESG. It's a definitive characteristic of just asset management in general. And the disclosure and stewardship, especially for asset managers, is already out there. Form NPX, which has been on the books for a while and which the SEC just recently amended, already requires a significant amount of disclosure in the space. We also noted it was unclear to us why the SEC elevated the E above the S or the G regardless of the fund, and why within the, you know, funds that have an E objective, why they would elevate the GHG emissions above any other metrics, environmental factors or metrics. We did not submit our own letter in the names rule. We worked with our trade associations for those letters, but I will note, and this is just my view, expanding the rule to cover portfolio characteristics rather than security characteristics, which is where the rule is right now, is just too subjective. There's a reason why this rule was not originally intended to cover strategy, and we believe that it should remain that way. In addition to the SEC, the Department of Labor also moved in this space to cover ERISA plans. So in 2020, and Jonathan would know this quite well, it adopted a rule to provide updated guideposts for fiduciaries of employee benefit plans governed by ERISA. The rule clarified that plan fiduciaries must select investments based on pecuniary factors, defined as factors that are expected to have a material effect on the risk return of an investment. With respect to ESG factors, and this is important, with respect to ESG factors, the DOL, unlike in the proposal, recognized that such factors could be pecuniary. The DOL proposed amendments to this rule in October of last year. The amendments would remove the definition of pecuniary, which was a pretty central piece of the 2020 rule, and instead stated that a prudent fiduciary may consider any factor that is material to the risk-return analysis. This regulation, by the way, the final rule is with the OMB, so it's expected to come out any day now. As far as BlackRock's position on the DOL rules, for both the 2020 rule and the 2021 amendments, we agree with the DOL's long-standing views with respect to ERISA fiduciaries, which must always put the economic interests of the plan in providing retirement benefits first and cannot sacrifice investment returns or take on additional risk to promote goals unrelated to the financial interests of the plan participants and beneficiaries. This is consistent with BlackRock's long-held views with respect to ESG integration. We do support the DOL's goal of making clearer how fiduciaries can consider ESG factors because certain aspects of the 2020 rule presented some investment and record-keeping challenges. So we were broadly supportive of the 2021 proposal and suggested some really marginal comments to improve. I'll pause here, and I will let Jonathan, one of the leading architects of the 2020 rule, add in his thoughts and correct me on where I went wrong with the 2020 rule. But thank you again for inviting me to participate today.
Thank you, Dahlia. And I have colleagues in the room who are more central to this, but I'll happily share the credit if it gets people to like me. So the through line in BlackRock's position, I want to take a step back here and point out with both BlackRock as well as the substance of these ESG regulations that Dahlia has just taken you through, the consistent thread is that they track elite preferences. And what do I mean by this? We can look at some of the survey data that's been submitted in the climate rulemaking, the climate disclosures rulemaking, for example. Consumers Research submitted a survey indicating that 70% of retail investors, that's living, breathing, natural person human beings, indicate that the primary use of their investment income is to save for retirement or to supplement their income, as opposed to the 3% who are seeking to drive sustainability and the 2% seeking to drive social change. Likewise, Professor Cunningham from GW, I believe, submitted a comment indicating that institutional investors vote for environmental shareholder proposals at about twice the rate of individual investors, and tied also to a survey that UChicago and FINRA did of over 1,000 retail investors, indicating that individual investors prioritize return on investment and other financial factors of the kind emphasized in the DOL rulemaking, emphasize those factors in their investment decision making more than any other factor. Individual investors, retail investors, identified environmental aspects of a potential investment as the least important consideration compared to financial, governance, and social factors. This tracks surveys of workers as well, of non-management workers. A recent survey by American Compass found 63% of non-management workers, working people, want businesses to, in their words, focus on business and stay out of social justice issues like election reform, racial equity, LGBTQ plus rights. The greatest levels of support for companies taking a public stance on behalf of social justice were white, college-educated Democrats at 77%. So I think it's fair to call ESG investing an elite preference, not a majority sentiment. And for this crowd, my fellow law nerds, I don't think I need to spend a lot of time explaining why it is that elite preferences and not majority views are what's getting encoded into the regulations on ESG that Dahlia just reviewed. The short answer, of course, is the administrative state. The medium answer is that the administrative state encodes elite preferences like ESG because it stands outside of our constitutional system of democratic accountability. This is the core problem with the delegation of legislative power to the executive branch, namely the distance it puts between public policies and the lawmakers who nominally own them. Even had the red wave materialized this week, and produced 501c3 and produced a radically different Congress. I'm not sure, and this is the point that's important for this conversation. I'm not sure that would have drastically altered the Biden administration's rulemaking agenda. Changes the legislative agenda, sure, but not the rulemaking agenda. No. Instead, what's happening is a steady progression of regulations reflecting elite priorities. In the ESG space, we see rules being justified by reference to shibboleths like climate-related financial risk and diversity. I can talk about those a little bit more maybe in the discussion. One of them is typically boils down to quotas on the basis of race and sex, which are commonly illegal under federal and many state laws. And the climate-related financial risk is also a concept worth unpacking. But I'm going to stay high level for now. But there's one justification put out in these rulemakings for mandating ESG disclosures that I want to speak to now. The SEC has repeatedly invoked investor demand as a rationale for mandating various ESG disclosures by public companies. But this investor demand is not arising spontaneously from ma and pa investor owning a few shares of Coca-Cola and clamoring for a diversity matrix that jams corporate leaders into identity politics boxes. Of course not. It's BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard and lots of other big institutional investors and asset managers purporting to speak on behalf of everyone who has their money parked there. But these big asset managers, they have agency and accountability problems of their own, like with the issue of delegation of legislative power. Recall the survey data I mentioned about actual retail investors, again, living, breathing human beings. overwhelmingly, they're not interested in net zero commitments or diversity quotas. But somehow, when BlackRock adds up all of their shares, it comes up with a progressive political agenda. And it doesn't stop there at this obvious gap between little investors and big Wall Street pools of capital. Indeed, at every level of money management removed from regular investors, there seems to be an agent channeling the funds to political agendas. Even when actual retail investors are given the opportunity to express their views, if they're allowed to by the asset manager, they're often limited to choosing among options provided by proxy advisors who themselves have an agenda and something approaching a duopoly, but I'll leave that to the antitrust experts. For example, the proxy advisor Institutional Shareholder Services, ISS, points investors to support policies like racial equity audits of companies. And even when actual retail investors retain their right to vote, their influence is nothing compared to the institutional influence that managers like BlackRock exert on companies every day through engagement. What investors face at the end stage is a series of choices that have been filtered by a dominated process. They face a deluge of progressive shareholder proposals, board director candidates, and company initiatives with no hope for influence or initiative of their own. To borrow a phrase from SEC Commissioner Hester Pierce, our system of corporate governance is becoming a series of, quote, pressure points that activists can use to strong arm, unquote, funds to advance their goals. Apparently, we're supposed to believe that it's the market demanding policy changes that line up quite nicely with the Biden administration's top priorities. But it is not the market. It is artificial layers of money managers created by public and private regulators. In this way, ESG is a vehicle for ideological control of capital allocation. So one last comparison between the public and private sector proponents of ESG regulations. They're all the same narrow class of people. And their functional accountability system is not responsibility to voters or investors, but to their own cohort. The revolving door is part of it, but a lot of what we call virtue signaling with asset managers or CEOs touting ESG practices is really messaging directed to one's own colleagues in the managerial class to broadcast and enhance one's own status. I want to end with a very interesting quote from the great Irving Kristol, writing about the growth of large corporations in the 70s. Quote, both the founding fathers and Adam Smith could not have interpreted the domination of economic activity by large corporate bureaucracies as representing, in any sense, the working of a system of natural liberty. Look forward to further discussion.
Thank you, Jonathan. Commissioner Wilson.
Thank you, Judge Oldham. Thanks to my fellow panelists for their very insightful and provocative views, and thanks also to the Federalist Society for inviting me to speak today. So I will also give the standard disclaimer: the views that I express here are decidedly not the views of any other Federal Trade Commissioner.
Seems safe.
Because my good friend and colleague and ally, Commissioner Noah Phillips, left about 3 weeks ago. We had his official going away party yesterday, and so now the task of writing lengthy dissents falls solely to me. And I just had a big one issued this morning, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. So, for those of you who are not familiar with the Federal Trade Commission, We exist to protect competition and consumers, and that has long been our mission. We are all about promoting free market forces and accurate, non-deceptive information in the marketplace so that rational consumers can make decisions for themselves. But that mission has changed now that we have new FTC leadership under President Biden. These folks call themselves neo-Brandeisians. They carry the mantle of Justice Brandeis, and they have allies both inside and outside the administration. So the most fundamental change at the Federal Trade Commission is the attempt to abandon what we at the FTC and what we antitrust lawyers call the consumer welfare standard. And that's a fancy way of saying we evaluate whether conduct is lawful based on how it impacts consumers. So will it raise prices, decrease quality, hamper innovation, decrease output? And if any of those things is true, absent other pro-competitive justifications, the conduct is likely going to be unlawful. But the neo-Brandeisians dislike the consumer welfare standard because they believe it was designed by elites to favor business at the expense of workers. And they view the sound economic underpinnings of antitrust enforcement as a fig leaf that justifies both the consumer welfare standard and the broader status quo. And so the overhaul of antitrust policy therefore requires ditching the consumer welfare standard and the economic framework that serves as its analytical foundation. So the neo-Brandeisians are vigorously working to shift the focus from consumers to workers. In describing the goals of antitrust, our chair, Chair Lina Khan, frequently references workers and honest businesses. Now, I've been in the private sector far longer than I've been in government, and I've counseled many, many companies. I would say roughly 99% of businesses are very interested in complying with the law. But workers and honest businesses is the mantra of Chair Khan and her fellow travelers. Sandeep Vahisan is one of the thought leaders in the neo-Brandeisian movement. He has co-authored various articles with Chair Khan, and he has embraced the concept that antitrust law is, quote, a once populist and progressive law against exploitation that has become the law for exploiters as efficiency and power win. And more recently, Vahisan explained that the FTC should, quote, treat low prices as an unfair method of competition because they exploit workers. So two developments are based on this fundamental belief. First, the FTC issued a policy statement on gig workers in September. Now, from a practical perspective, it's clear that the gig worker policy statement is meant to shift our enforcement, because we actually, in our consumer protection mission, already look very closely at inflated earnings claims for potential investors or independent contractors. We chase down and enforce against deceptive franchise opportunities and other unfair and deceptive practices that may harm consumers when they are pursuing a livelihood. And on the competition side, we already investigate whether proposed mergers or types of business conduct harm competition for labor as an input. So in other words, competition for employees. But this policy statement goes much further. It focuses on gig workers to the exclusion of consumers and other economic actors. And at the Open Commission meeting, this was fascinating to me, the speakers who signed up to share their views with the commission were lots and lots of gig workers who were very concerned that we were about to issue a gig worker policy statement. They said, we really like our jobs. Please don't insert yourself into this and mess up our livelihoods. Second, the National Labor Relations Board and the FTC recently signed a memorandum of understanding. According to the general counsel of the NLRB, this MOU will help the two agencies tackle complicated workplace issues, including gig work, the ability of workers to act collectively, and the classification and treatment of workers. Now, I do not object to partnering with other federal agencies where we have expertise that we can actually contribute. So we work with the Food and Drug Administration frequently to identify anti-competitive conduct in the pharma space that would raise prices illegally for consumers. I'm not aware of any expertise that the FTC possesses on the proper classification of workers or many other topics in the MOU. But here's the thing. The MOU could now allow the NLRB investigation concerning classifying independent contractors to morph into an FTC-related matter about worker misclassification. So instead of using the FTC's limited resources to enforce antitrust and consumer protection laws and facilitate the functioning of free markets, we're going to help the NLRB turn one labor investigation into two labor investigations. The second effort that I want to address is changing the FTC's strategic plan. As I mentioned at the outset, we have long existed to promote competition and protect consumers. But in August, the Commission issued its strategic plan for fiscal years 2022 to 2026. The majority's vision for the agency expands its mission to include goals outside our statutory remit. The agency lacks the expertise and, in fact, the jurisdiction to pursue the additional societal goals that are now embodied in the strategic plan. And of course, pursuing those goals is going to distract from the important work that we actually have to do and that we were established to accomplish. And my friend Doug is going to talk a little bit more about that. So for instance, the new strategic plan requires enhancing FTC employees' understanding of how climate change impacts the FTC. And our performance metrics will cover the number of training and information offerings to staff on climate literacy and resilience topics. So Chair Kahn has frequently told Congress that we are stretched too thin and understaffed. If we're stretched so thin, why are we offering our employees classes on climate change, and how does that help our mission? We've also seen a focus on racial minorities over other consumers, and let me be clear, I believe that each person is created in the image of God. I abhor discrimination. But the FTC mandate does not include or encompass the pursuit of racial equity. In 2020, Commissioner Slaughter, who is still on the commission, proclaimed that there has not been nearly enough discussion about whether our antitrust laws can play a role in racial equity, and that her opinion was that antitrust can and should be anti-racist. Then, in a draft strategic plan put out for public comment, one objective was to advance racial equity through the FTC's competition mission. In the final strategic plan for 2022 to 2026, the language was slightly modified. Now our mission is to support equity for historically underserved communities. And this shows up in both the competition and consumer protection missions. So the insertion of these additional goals into our strategic plan means, of course, that consumer welfare cannot be maximized because it's, you know, it's a mathematical truism that you can only maximize one value at a time. And so we are choosing to step back from doing what's in the best interest of consumers and substituting other goals instead. And then finally, I want to focus on changes to our in-depth merger reviews. So we enforce the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act, which says that mergers that are of a certain size or value need to be notified to us and reviewed by us to determine whether they will result in a reduction in competition before they are allowed to proceed. And so, as I've mentioned, including in testimony before the committee for which Doug works, we have long looked at labor issues in the sense that competition for labor as an input is an important and relevant issue. And so if we are going to, if there's a merger that will create what's called a monopsony, it's essentially a monopoly buyer, a monopsony for labor as an input, we will step in and remedy that, and we have done so. But Chair Kahn has moved into areas of inquiry in what we call our second request, our in-depth merger investigations, that have nothing to do with the Clayton Act or Section 7 violations or the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. For example, I don't know what collective bargaining and unionization have to do with analyzing whether a merger is going to raise prices or decrease output or suppress innovation or otherwise harm consumers. And we've seen similar rhetoric unrelated to competition that displays a clear distaste for private equity as a business model. We've seen remedies imposed on private equity companies even when evidence uncovered in investigations indicates that private equity involvement has no influence on whether competition concerns are going to arise. And in fact, we have imposed heightened legal obligations on private equity companies as opposed to other companies who stand in similar situations, which obviously is a concern, imposing heightened legal obligations on disfavored groups like private equity because of who they are rather than what they've done raises rule of law concerns. So one final note. Some of you may have seen today that the FTC released a new Section 5 policy statement. Section 5 of the FTC Act gives the Federal Trade Commission authority to prohibit unfair methods of competition. And legislative history makes clear that Section 5 was intended to be broader than the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, the other antitrust laws. The new Section 5 policy statement says that the commission is now going to seek to advance the welfare of inefficient competitors, workers, and other unnamed but politically favored groups at the expense of consumers. And so if we can label conduct exploitive, oppressive, abusive, we're not going to look at business justifications, we're not going to look at efficiencies, we're not going to look at pro-competitive benefits. We are essentially going to label it per se unlawful. This is a major, sweeping development that is going to enable the FTC to attempt to remake the U.S. economy. To conclude, in recent testimony, Chair Khan promised she was not listening to ESG concerns and letting mergers go through that promise better ESG results. That may be true, but what I have seen is a willingness to use every conceivable tool to block mergers, including potential ESG harms. And then I think as a way of segueing to Doug, and Doug is going to talk a little bit about this, the last time the FTC went this far afield of its mission, we were stripped of funding, we were stripped of legal authority, and we were required to institute new and substantial procedural hurdles to foster public trust. I fear we're heading down a similar road, but I'm not going to be surprised, and I'm also not going to be disappointed when Congress steps in.
Thank you, Commissioner Wilson. Last but certainly not least, Mr. Geho.
Hi, Doug Geho, and I'll also give the standard caveat. I'm not speaking on behalf of the House Judiciary Committee or any member. These are just my views and observations. I was invited to give a description of or set of perspectives on ESG and antitrust policy and enforcement from Capitol Hill. And so that's what I'll try to do here in three points, two that are more brief, and the first of which relates in part to what Commissioner Wilson was describing. The third seeks to draw from how recent discussions of antitrust more generally on Capitol Hill, how those discussions could inform our understanding of where congressional interest in antitrust and ESG could lead. So point one, some in Congress have voiced strong concern about broadening antitrust policy goals or legal standards in ways that could help regulators and enforcers push companies toward ESG. So for example, one member has criticized, quote, the objective of repurposing antitrust law, unquote, listed a series of ESG-related issues, and then said, it is inappropriate to use antitrust law to advance these priorities, and went on to say, Congress must not overlook how antitrust law is currently insulated from arbitrary enforcement for projects and policy objectives distinct from the competitive process itself, unquote. So in ending on this first point, I'd say that to the extent enforcers are seeking to broaden antitrust ambit without congressional authorization, that has drawn Congress's attention already and will probably continue to, and there may be more time to discuss that momentarily. Point two, on the Hill, there is also strong concern that private sector efforts to advance ESG may break antitrust laws. And here I'll provide two examples. A lot's happened over the last week, so some of us may not have seen this, but Senator Cotton and several other Republican senators sent a what I thought was a remarkable letter, and I'll quote from it because the language is important. This letter was sent to 51 large U.S. and global law firms and amounted to a preservation request relating to ESG and antitrust inquiries. Here's the Here's the letter. The ESG part of the most striking language. The ESG movement attempts to weaponize corporations to reshape society in ways that Americans would never endorse at the ballot box. Of particular concern is the collusive effort to restrict the supply of coal, oil, and gas, which is driving up energy costs across the globe and empowering America's adversaries abroad. The letter went on to say that Congress will increasingly use its oversight powers to scrutinize, quote, institutionalized antitrust violations being committed in the name of ESG and refer those violations to the FTC and the Department of Justice. And I'll get to this in my third point, but I think that kind of inquiry has significance regardless of what the outcome of any particular election cycle may be for any given party. The second quote is an example from Leader McCarthy. When asked about ESG and certain companies involved in the process of advising on ESG-related goals, he was asked about whether these entities engage in antitrust violation. He said, you're right, 100%, and went on to say ESG is making the entire country weaker. It's making China and India stronger. It's destroying our companies, and it is playing politics. So those are two quick descriptions of different aspects of how ESG and antitrust relate in recent congressional discourse. The third point I'm going to make is a conclusion, and then I'll show my work. And it attempts to synthesize my understanding of how congressional debates over antitrust generally have unfolded recently, and see if that offers us any clues as to where the current focus on ESG and antitrust may lead. So point three in the conclusion is that congressional interest in antitrust and ESG is likely to be enduring unless Congress sees corporate America step back from ESG and related social activism or policies. To unpack that, there has been a meaningful change or shift in the rule of thumb that guides how some on Capitol Hill react to antitrust questions or regulatory proposals. And it's that change in the rule of thumb that I think helps suggest the interest in ESG and antitrust will be enduring. It used to be the case, say 10 years ago, that almost all Republicans would have said categorically, big is not bad or big is not necessarily bad. Today, though, at least some Republicans would likely say, as a default rule of thumb, big is not bad unless big is woke. And I think what accounts for that evolution in the rule of thumb or heuristic is important because whether it maps on well to ESG and antitrust depends on what's driving that shift. And first, I think it's important to say what has not driven that change in the rule of thumb. I'd posit that that shift is not due to new economic understanding or widespread deep study of antitrust doctrine on Capitol Hill that justifies renouncing all prior understandings. In other words, it's not as if Congress has reconvened the Antitrust Modernization Commission and then been told in a subsequent set of recommendations and a lengthy report, we were wrong 15 years ago, throw everything out the window. That has not happened. Instead, I think the evolution in the rule of thumb that I described is a function of how many big businesses are willing to march in unison on cultural or political issues. Stated differently, partisan corporate social activism is animating significant backlash against corporate America in some quarters. And it's not hard to come up with ways to characterize this type of social activism or corporate decision making. For example, denying goods or services or opportunities to certain speakers or viewpoints that challenge progressive orthodoxies. Suppressing or demonetizing or disassociating with dissenting views. Another way of thinking about this might be asking why corporate America generally seems to calibrate its moral compass with views that might come from the Southern Poverty Law Center or BLM, but turns a deaf ear to other viewpoints from organizations like Alliance Defending Freedom or the America First Policy Institute. So that's a description of the shift in the rule of thumb and how it's evolved over time. I think whether or not that rule of thumb applies in this context turns on some members in Congress think of or perceive ESG. In other words, is ESG perceived as woke or as worthwhile on Capitol Hill? And I'll give some quotations to help, again, we have limited time, but illustrate how some perceive ESG. A recently elected soon-to-be member of the Senate, has said, ESG is basically a massive racket to enrich Wall Street and enrich the financial sector of the country at the expense of industries that actually employ workers in middle-class jobs. Another congressman recently said, ESG investing is a cancer within our capital markets. It is a fraud on American investors, and there is a need for institutions to stop this nonsense of politicizing capital allocation. And the last quote is not from a member of Congress, but I'm including it because I do think it captures the sentiment of some members of Congress. Quote, and this is Peter Thiel, ESG is just a hate factory. It's a factory for naming enemies. So in conclusion of this third point, given how debates about antitrust have unfolded on Capitol Hill and that evolution in the rule of thumb I described and the perceptions in some quarters of ESG, I think unless something changes, congressional interest in antitrust and ESG and the nexus between the two will be around for quite some time. Thanks, and I look forward to discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Gijo. So for all those in the audience who are old hands at this, you know the drill. I'll have some panel discussion, and then we're going to open up for audience questions. There's mics on either side of the auditorium, so feel free to queue up while we are discussing. So let's why don't we go back and start with Ms. Blass, and I want to give you an opportunity to answer anything that came up in Mr. Berry's remarks that you might want to answer. And I was also hoping that you might be able to sort of help us understand, for those of us in the audience who are not institutional investors, if you can try to unpack the idea of what are so-called ESG risks or ESG metrics. So everyone in the audience knows that ESG stands for environmental social governance. And I think we have some general sense of kind of what we're supposed to be capturing when we talk about these concepts. But it might also be unclear to folks, how do we measure these things? How do they influence corporate accounting or corporate governance? And one of the other points that Mr. Berry arose that I hope you might be able to answer too in your remarks is if you could tell us how do we unpack the idea that ESG is in some sense a response to market demand, but it is folks like BlackRock or institutional investors who are the source of the demand. How do we unpack the chicken and egg problem?
Thank you for that. Actually, as I was listening, there's so much, so many threads I could pull here and respond to. So I will try. let me start with ESG because I do think there is a tremendous amount of misperceptions, perhaps about what ESG is or is not, and what we do with it. But let me round back to something I said in my opening remarks because financial services is a very, very diverse industry. BlackRock and us asset managers like BlackRock, when you hear about, we have about like $8 trillion of assets under management, that is not our money. And it's not captive money, right? So our investors, if they don't like what we do, they can redeem their funds. We're not a balance sheet business. That's a very important point. ESG. Let me just give you an example. I think this is sort of the way, I'm not an investor, by the way. I'll add that as a caveat as well, but let me just give you an example. Let's say that you are an investor and you are looking at commercial real estate and commercial real estate on a shoreline of this great United States of America. You look at two buildings and they are exactly the same. Every single thing about those two buildings is the same. It's the same developer, it's the same size, it's the same year, it's the same materials, whatever else goes into construction. There is one difference between the two. One of them is 2 feet above sea level. One of them is 20 feet above sea level. And let me make this a little bit more interesting. Let's say it's in the shoreline of Florida, which, by the way, our thoughts obviously are with Florida right now because they are, unfortunately, the second time in a row facing a pretty devastating hurricane. Are you not going to take that into account as you invest? That is what an investor does. You look at these risks. That is a climate risk. Let me go to governance just to give you another example. And Jonathan, you mentioned boards and diversity. which is not a narrow definition, and that's really important to think about that. You know, diversity spans anything from demographic characteristics to professional experience. Do you have a certain specialty that would lend itself to the board and the business? It is a very vast definition, and there are studies out there that show a correlation between diversity in all its forms, by the way, it is not a static singular definition, and performance by the company. There's a lot of studies out there. So as long-term investors, we do look at that because it drives value. Diversity drives value. And that's something else that's really important because, you know, Judge Oldham, you started your remarks about, you know, the BRT mm-hmm. and the change in purpose. I actually run our Center for Long-Term Capitalism. And what does that mean? By the way, at its core, the primacy of shareholder value is there. That shareholders own the corporation. So you cannot say, they're the legal owners. The benefit, the value inures always to them. So there's always going to be this shareholder value and the primacy of the shareholder. What you look at to drive this long-term durable return for the shareholder, and we're doing research in this space and it's really exciting, you look at what factors can drive this long-term value. That is when at least when we at BlackRock talk about long-term capitalism, when we talk about, you know, stakeholder capitalism, it's not equal. We do look at what factors drive a long-term shareholder value. And we just published a great piece, and you can find it on our website. We call it the Great Resignation, looking at when you look at employees and the turnover, by the way, there is a correlation between performance and turnover. The higher the turnover, the less performance. So we look at what is driving employee to leave or to stay and how that could impact. This is how you drive long-term value for your shareholders. And that's the bottom line for us, by the way, when it comes to ESG, when it comes to all this. At BlackRock, our work is research and data driven. That is what we do, research and data. And we pride ourselves on doing that. So when we look at ESG, when we look at climate risks, when we look at ESG risks, when we look at ESG integration, which by the way, ESG integration at its core is you look at our portfolio managers, they look for unpriced investment risks and opportunities. That is ESG integration. So when you look at that, you are looking at the drivers of value, and our work in this space is research and data driven. I do want to touch, if I may, on competition, because that has also kind of come up here. So I'll just three threads I'll pull here. One, the industry, and I know, you know, Jonathan, you mentioned, you know, BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. This industry is over, just in the United States, over $100 trillion. It is it's a large industry. It's also a very diverse industry. So of that $100 trillion, BlackRock manages about $8 trillion. Our percentage revenue share in this big industry is 3%. It's a big, diverse industry. It's very competitive. And it's also an industry, by the way, really look at the history of it, because it's really important to see how much good has been driven by this industry. Index funds were introduced in the markets in the mid-70s. In 1980, United States household owned about 5% were actually invested. U.S. household, 5%, only 5% were invested in the markets. Today, it's about half. Why? Because of these funds. It's accessible. It is affordable. It is cheap. It is easy and it's professionally managed. That is what the industry has provided, affordable, accessible venues into the United States capital markets, not for the elites, for the retails, for the human beings. And by the way, at BlackRock, we're 19,000 living, breathing human beings, by the way, just to know there. Cost, we've actually published a paper on that one, the economies of scale, showing how much this industry and how much index investing has brought down a cost, not just for index investors, by the way, but across the market because of substitution strategies. So tremendous power in there as well. And then I just want to end with one point, voting. Voting is very important. And Jonathan, you mentioned voting and voting statistics in there. BlackRock has been a leader and pioneer in voting choice. We were the first asset manager to do it. We are very, we're delighted to see two other asset managers now join us on this table. About half of our index equity is eligible for voting choice. Voting choice essentially means that they can take the vote. They can participate in this. And this room is full of attorneys, and I invite you to join us in something, because the next frontier needs to be breached. And that next frontier is, how can we in the United States solve the legal and operational challenges so that every investor has the right to a voting choice, so that we can democratize voting even more and more. There are lots of hurdles in the United States. We're going to be rolling out a pilot in the United Kingdom, where the legal operation the infrastructure allows us to go more retail. We are not able to do that yet in the United States. But we are investing our resources, our time, our talent, and effort to push voting choice out more and more, because we do feel that is very, very important. It's the next step in providing choice in the United States market. So I invite you to join us in this effort.
Thank you very much, Ms. Blass. Mr. Berry, obviously any response you have to that, in particular, I wanted to give you some space if you wanted to unpack the some of what you understood as ESG risks or the net zero commitments. These are buzzwords that we often hear in these panels, but are not perhaps as accessible to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me say at the outset, I agree 100% with Dahlia that the advent of index funds, these broadly diversified investment vehicles that have made very low cost offerings available to a lot of mom and pops and retail investors is commendable, and I include in that absolutely BlackRock's role specifically in propagating that investment model. There's a tremendous amount to be said for that. Where I start to differ, you may find it hard to believe that I differ on a few points, is that let's start in reverse order with voting choice. A few observations. One is that while BlackRock is indeed starting to pioneer a certain amount of pass-through voting to some of its clients, it's not doing pass-through engagement. There's no mechanism available by which I, as the underlying investor, get to engage on behalf of my own shares. It's still BlackRock employees in the room with the issuer when it comes to that. And a related point is that, at least as of yet, and if they're going to change their ways on this, that's, there can be a conversation on that. BlackRock on its SEC filings, I believe, I'm not an expert, this is 13G, 13F, does not segregate those shares where it retains voting rights and where it has indeed passed those back. So as far as the issuer sitting at the other end of the conference table knows, BlackRock is still accountable for, is wielding, is representing whatever percentage, 8, 12, 15, whatever percent of that corporation's total shares. And then third, oftentimes, at least in terms of what we've seen so far on who is the recipient of these pass-through votes, voting power, it's pushing the agency problem down one level. Because with large institutional clients like public pension funds, to put it gently, a lot of those pension funds are not the most rigorous financial pecuniary fiduciaries of pensioners' assets. I'm looking forward to the Illinois bailout. I'm not. Similarly, a lot of the choices are shaped by a limited menu of options selected by the proxy advisor duopoly, ISS and Glass Lewis. Now onto the substance of ESG. So it would be a very straightforward violation of fiduciary duty for a fiduciary like BlackRock. This applies to any company as an issuer, and I know BlackRock is an issuer as well, that for them to simply come out and say, we are not taking action X because of financial considerations or long-term value. We just think separately this is the right thing to do. We care about the climate simply as such, with no relationship to our business operations. You can't say that. There's a lot of ways to tag that liability-wise, but short answer is you can't. So instead, what happens are these predicates that get developed that are, for lack of a better way to put it, strategically equivocal. on both, and I'll use climate and diversity as the most prominent examples of this. Diversity, sort of maybe in some sense a simpler topic, insofar as the element of race, for example, remains one of the qualifying ways by which one can become an underrepresented minority eligible for the preferential treatment satisfying BlackRock's current voting guidelines, for example, which do set minimums in terms of underrepresented as well as women. That's hard not to call out as a violation of Section 1981, banning race discrimination in private contracting. The fact that there are non-racial ways to satisfy that does not cleanse the policy of that taint. That's like saying, okay, well, to fill this job, you've either got to be white or from San Francisco. Well, it's possible to satisfy that, to fill that, without taking race into account. But the inclusion of the racial element is a violation. The evidence on diversity and corporate performance, by the way, as if private money making could ever be a justification for this kind of discrimination, as if the evidence is not there in terms of causation. Even the I believe it was the late Stanford law professor Deborah Rohde, feminist and really acclaimed thinker. She concluded her own literature review that the empirical evidence for board sex diversity improving corporate performance was not there. And she said explicitly, I still support this, but let's be clear, it's for social justice and equity reasons. If you're really interested in the subject, you can pull up our filings that we sent to the SEC on the NASDAQ diversity rulemaking. And the evidence is even worse when it comes to racial and sexual minority diversity. It's just not there. Finally, and maybe most profoundly, apologies for the length, climate-related financial risk. Let's break this up into its two core components. There is physical weather risk and what's referred to as transition risk. You can call it political or policy risk. So physical risk is the example that Dahlia gave with the two different buildings. The difficulty is, with that hypothetical, I think it's not hard to say that at least in the case of the building that's 2 feet above sea level or whatever, there may be a material consideration regarding flooding, sea level rise, right there. But what's actually going on in the main is not something where there's such a direct correlation between the business position and any kind of physical risk. What's being associated here is greenhouse gas emissions. And the thing with greenhouse gas emissions is they don't affect the emitters' risk physically one bit. I could have one business that's selling carbon offsets. It's all they do, perched on Martha's Vineyard, and another, a coal-fired power plant on the top of a mountain, and the emissions would have from each of these respectively would have nothing to do, to do with their physical risk. So that leaves transition risk. Transition risk is it's a sticky concept. I think it has some legitimacy, understanding that you've got your present corporate assets right now that may lose some or all of their value if they become what's called stranded. So carbon-intensive capital expenditures, if there is much tighter carbon emission regulation or something in the future, they may lose their value. The problem is this is very speculative. This is not susceptible to quantification and data because these are essentially political judgments. And the way you can tell that they're political judgments reflecting a particular ideology is all the transition risks that get left out. What about the risk of supply chains with China being cut off because we are entering into a phase of great power competition with the communist Chinese? Why is that not an obviously more short-term transition risk for all kinds of businesses, publicly traded and otherwise, that have work overseas? So I can go on, but there's a lot I'd like to try to clear up.
Thank you, sir. Commissioner Wilson, far be it for me to defend the Neo-Brindisians, but given everything that we've heard today, I'm wondering why those who say the consumer welfare model is outdated aren't right. I mean, if we've completely redefined the purpose of the corporation, we're no longer thinking about shareholder return as the purpose, why would we not want to broaden the consumer welfare model too?
So I think the approach of the Neo-Brindisians is essentially to discredit the consumer welfare standard by being very dishonest about what it does and does not do. And so they argue that it focuses solely on short-term price, and that is actually an incredibly inaccurate characterization. We look at short-term and long-term price, we look at quality, we look at choice, we look at innovation, and it is a very broad and flexible standard, but at bottom boils down to a balancing of the pro-competitive effects and the anti-competitive effects of a type of business conduct. And so it is not amorphous and open-ended in the same sense that a replacement standard would be. And the consumer welfare standard ticks all the boxes for things that you want in government enforcement. It is administrable because the variables are finite, right? What are the anti-competitive effects? What are the harms to consumers? What are the benefits to consumers? And it is quantifiable. It is predictable in the sense that we're maximizing one value. We're looking at the impact on consumers. As a way of clarifying this, in fact, it's not just the end consumer. It is other businesses in the supply chain who are either sellers or buyers. And so it's not, we use consumer as shorthand, but it is a number of different participants in the supply chain who may be harmed in the traditional antitrust sense by a certain type of conduct. So the consumer welfare standard is administrable, it is predictable, and it is credible because it isn't subject to the vicissitudes of Washington politics, right? We're not choosing different goals depending on which way the political winds are blowing. Is labor important? Are small businesses important? And that sort of thing. Doug mentioned the alleged collusion among certain firms now, and the desire to insulate that collusion from the enforcement of the antitrust laws. In fact, antitrust says exemptions from the antitrust laws should be rare, few, far between, because competition is the bedrock of the economy in this country. But the Neo-Brindisians say collusion is good if you are politically favored. And so certain types of suppliers are allowed to collude, but others are not. So the consumer welfare standard provides rigor to antitrust enforcement. So what happens when you inject all of these other goals into antitrust enforcement? We don't know which goals. Even the Section 5 policy statement that was released this morning says that we are going to focus on benefits to labor, small businesses, honest businesses, and other unnamed constituencies. And so how do we know from an ex-ante perspective what enforcement is going to look like? Which goal are we going to try to maximize? How do we weight the different goals? What if the goals conflict? And so we are essentially opening ourselves up to the politicization of antitrust enforcement. And in fact, Chair Khan has said, she did an interview on Stuart Varney, and she said, all decisions, all government enforcement decisions are political. The beautiful thing about antitrust enforcement is that we've had a bipartisan consensus for a very long time. And between administrations, Republican and Democrat, you see changes at the margins. But there is a consensus, a broad consensus, about the purpose of antitrust. That consensus has now been unraveled. And so I would submit the only way to keep sound antitrust enforcement in this country is to continue focusing on the consumer welfare standard.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Mr. Geo, I'm curious to pick up on that last point that the Commissioner raised. If you see anything from a bipartisan perspective on the Hill where there's any kind of prospect of further development on ESG and antitrust, or if this is going to remain sort of a partisan question on the margin.
Yeah, so I'm very interested in what the answer to that question will be as time passes. I think there are a few data points we can look to. I mean, last week there were no, one data point, there were no Democrat signatures on the oversight letter that Senator Cotton sent. That's interesting because there has been bipartisan oversight in the Senate on antitrust related issues recently. Another interesting data point, I think, also relates to that letter, but it's how the letter has been received in the legal and scholarly community, or kind of popular summations of what the legal community might think. One legal blog said, it pointed to scholarship suggesting and advocating for immunizing ESG-related efforts, and the rationale was that even though anti-competitive acts may be committed as part of pursuing ESG-related goals, because the objective or purpose, the intent, is to promote dealing with ESG-related issues, it's not to compete poorly, there should be official immunization for that type of behavior. The reason I'm getting into that is because we have seen in Congress recent largely Democrat-driven, although there is some bipartisanship around certain bills, but there are attempts to, for a period of time, permit cartels to be created and collective action to occur for certain favored industries. So given how high in the order of allegiances for this administration, for example, or the Democrat Party generally, especially the E and ESG seems to be, I could see proposals being introduced that would seek to immunize some of this type of inclusive behavior from antitrust enforcement. I guess the last data point, and this gets back to the title of the panel, but there are different ways to push for ESG and for enforcers or regulators to push ESG, and one way is by not bringing investigation or enforcement because of direction from whatever party is in control of the White House. On the one hand, there has been kind of recent lip service in Senate oversight by our current antitrust enforcers to the doctrine that says there is no exemption for collusion, whether with respect to ESG or otherwise. On the other hand, though, I think given, again, how high in this administration's priorities certain climate change-related efforts are, I have a hard time seeing our current enforcers robustly chasing the thread or pulling the thread that Senator Cotton would like them to pull.
Brilliant. Thank you. Let's do some audience questions. Let's start over on this side.
Yes, hi, Jim Copeland from Manhattan Institute. I've got a question for Ms. Blass. On engagement specifically, right, there are different types of investors in the market. So at the one end, you have sort of the price setters, and these are activist hedge funds at the most extreme that are doing deep dive research into companies, placing big bets, buying big parts of companies, and they're going long, they're going short, and in some cases, they're leaning into companies and saying, we want you to change management, spin off this, change dividend policy, change investment policy, et cetera. At the other end are passive index vehicles. I agree completely with you and Jonathan. These are great for individual investors. I invest in passive index vehicles. But you're, in fact, not doing that, right? What you're doing is replicating a market basket that's set by S&P or someone else and explicitly not researching the companies, not making short sales, not doing strategic buying and selling. You're decidedly not buying or selling companies based on employee turnover or board diversity or how high you are above sea level. So given that you're a low-cost vehicle replicating a market basket and you're not being market tested, an active investor in the long run to make money is going to have to be right more often than they're wrong on their bets so that they're paying off for the individuals who give them capital. You're replicating the market basket one way or the other. Why should we trust you, and why should you in the first place, even in any situation, be engaging with specific companies, telling them how to manage their business? Because you're not even deciding whether you buy or sell them in the first place.
Thank you for that question. I appreciate it. So by the way, just for the sake of clarity, BlackRock is an active investor and an index investor. We actually run both types of funds, but your question is specifically with respect to our index strategies. So with index strategies, number one, they're very diverse. You can go from a niche into broad market indices like the S&P 500. Because you are actually captive, if you will, because you cannot walk with your feet, which is what you can do as an active investor looking at fundamentals, this is where engagement and voting actually does matter. If you want to make sure that you are really representing as a fiduciary, representing the clients who have entrusted you with your assets, you do engage with companies to understand how they are managing their risks. And by the way, this is all their risks. It's not ESG. It is all their risks. So you engage to understand how they manage their risks and how they look for opportunities, because that is what drives long-term value. And if you feel that the company is not managing those risks or not looking for the opportunities in the right way, you exercise the power of the vote, because that is the one power you do have, and it's your client's assets. It's really important as a fiduciary that you don't take a sideline on that one, right? So you encourage disclosure. You look at that disclosure. You study that disclosure. And then you hold the directors who are responsible for the particular area, you do hold those accountable. Just a couple more points on that one. Our principles on how we vote are guidelines. They're public, they're very transparent. The issues we voted on, they're public, they're very transparent. How we voted, they're public, they're very transparent. You can find them year in, year out on our website. And as far as the point, Jonathan, you made on the engagement, the power of engagement, and that 13DG does not give you the information, the information is there. The 13DG, if you combine it with the NPX, you will find out exactly how much was voted by BlackRock versus how much was not voted. So the math is there. But we do go out there and we do engage. And by the way, this is just a small point we'll underline here. BlackRock, we have the largest stewardship team in the industry because we do believe it's really important to be out there on behalf of our clients. We do engage. We do want to understand how these issuers are managing their risks, right? So we're not following guidelines by a proxy advisor. We are independent in how we vote. We do our own independent research, and we independently vote in all the matters. And all that is very public and very transparent.
Thank you, Ms. Blass. Go over on to the side.
Yes, hi, thank you. Paul Kaminar. I filed comments against the NASDAQ board diversity rule, as well as the SEC's climate control disclosure rule on behalf of the National Legal and Policy Center. Two quick questions to Ms. Blass. With regard to your investment, I understand BlackRock disinvested in certain thermal coal companies at the request of environmental activists, and yet at the request of others, you did not divest in Chinese companies, which are controlled by the Communist Party there, that engages in extraordinary human rights abuses. So I wanted to know what do you decide when to divest in those kinds of companies? And secondly, why did BlackRock vote against the shareholder proposal that we submitted to Google and Meta that would simply require those companies to disclose requests that they get from the federal government to censor speech on their platforms, whether it's from HHS, CDC, FBI? You all voted against that good government disclosure proposal.
Thank you for that question. So let me, on your second one, if I may, I'm not going to comment on any particular shareholder proposal. I'm not part of the stewardship team. There's a lot of analysis that goes into that. So if I may, I will defer on that one. On the investments, I think you were asking about thermal coal and, and Chinese companies. So in thermal coal, BlackRock took the position that companies that have, I think it was a 25% exposure to thermal coal, that we would we'd not have those in our active portfolios. That decision was made by our active portfolios, and it was based on performance. This was a pure decision based on how the performance of these companies, our outlook on the performance of these companies. It was not politically motivated. It's neutral to that. We don't do that at BlackRock. But by the way, there are index strategies. You cannot take that position. And if a specific client disagreed with that, again, it's their choice. It's their money. So that's just to explain the thermal coal. On China, a little bit here, because I think there's also a lot of misconceptions about this. Our business in China is actually really new and small. It was the licenses that we received to open our business in China that was done pursuant to the trade agreement that was done under Mr. Trump. And the trade agreement, the purpose of that trade agreement was to open up the Chinese market to U.S. financial services, to the U.S. financial services sector. BlackRock, in any and every jurisdiction in which we operate, we follow the law. If there are sanctions, if there are restrictions, we follow those sanctions and restrictions. That just is something that's really important. And as far as, you know, human rights, I mean, that's obviously something that's really important. Going back to stakeholder versus shareholder, one of the things that's really important is, you know, how are companies operating in the space? We do look at that. It's part of our stewardship. It's really important, and we apply that globally. I hope that answers your question.
Well, with that, I'm afraid that we have reached. I would be a terrible moderator if I did not do the one thing that I was supposed to do, which is to end us on time. So we have reached the end of our allotted time. I cannot thank our esteemed panelists enough for giving us the time and expertise today, and I hope you'll give them a round of applause.